You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, with London's streets awash with Olympic advertising, we try to discover how a cheeky brand might try and hijack the event at the final hurdle. We'll explain why soaking a Chinese brand in salt water makes it more palatable to a domestic market, and we'll be talking to a man who can justifiably blow his own trumpet, or in this case, Alp horn.
One is on the Alpenhorn and the other one is on the Büchel. It's a special Swiss horn. You want to listen now?
And we'll also talk to our senior editor, Sophie Grove, about the ongoing crisis in South Sudan. Plus, we'll play you a few good songs too. That's all coming up here in the next hour, right on Monocle 24. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The European Union has tightened an arms embargo on Syria and expanded other sanctions as the conflict between President Bashar al-Assad and rebels escalates towards civil war. The new embargo rules require EU countries to search planes and ships if they have reasonable grounds to suspect they're carrying arms, dual-use goods, or equipment used for repression to Syria. The EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton gave the details at a press conference.
European Union countries will be obliged to inspect vessels and aircraft heading to Syria if they suspect the cargo contains arms or equipment for internal repression. It applies in member states' seaports and airports, as well as their territorial waters, in accordance with international law.
Mrs. Ashton said it would be up to each member state individually to find the best way to implement the measure. The American man accused of killing 12 people in a shooting at a Batman film screening in Aurora, Colorado, has appeared in court for the first time. The man, 24-year-old James Holmes, sat in court in a red prison suit with dyed orange hair. 9 of 58 people wounded by the gunman remain in critical condition. A gunman wearing an Afghan uniform has turned his weapon against foreign trainers working for NATO at the western province of Herat, killing 3 people. The shootings come at the end of a grim 24 hours for the coalition government, which also saw 5 NATO soldiers killed. United Nations spokesman Brigadier General Gunter Katz gave details to correspondents.
What I can confirm is that there was a shooting at Herat. The shooter has worn the uniform of the Afghan National Police. Respective authorities are looking into this incident. They are investigating those incidents. And this is all I really can say in this moment.
Earlier media reports suggest the 3 dead were all American contractors, but these have not been confirmed. Spain's economy has sunk deeper into recession in the second quarter, according to its central bank. It's believed investors have been spooked by an undeclared funding crisis in the Spanish regions and are pushing the country ever closer to a full bailout. The Bank of Spain monthly report showed that economic output shrank by 0.4% in the 3 months from April to June, having slumped by 0.3% in the first quarter. The European Commission has said the next disbursement of aid for Greece will probably not be paid before September. International lenders first have to finish an assessment of Greek reforms that are far behind schedule. Thousands of people have fled their homes in India's northeastern Assam state after fighting between indigenous tribes and Muslim settlers killed at least 19 people and left villages in flames. Police were forced to fire warning shots to disperse armed groups that were moving between jungle hamlets, setting fire to bamboo houses. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. It's 18:04 here in London, which means it's 13:04 in New York. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London is New York, is Hong Kong, is the Tokyo. Seen on Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monaco 24.
London Bo, as a Monaco 24.
Londra'dan, burası Monaco 24.
Londonist, sinun Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
O que que ninat teiru no wa Monaco 24.
Aftoinen to Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
Viestes Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Detta är Monaco 24.
En Monaco 24 hardware.
London sees a new luxury face on one of its most elite streets this week. Bozideng, a Chinese clothing brand, is opening its doors. Its target market is not entirely British-based, however. Instead, in a complicated marketing move, it's hoping that Chinese shoppers visiting the UK will see the shop and start thinking of Bozideng as sophisticated and European. Indeed, only 10% of the products in Bozideng's Bond Street store will carry a Made in China label. It's a sign that not even the Chinese want to buy local. So, is opening a shop in the UK the closest thing to brand laundering? To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Paul French, Chief China Analyst for Mintel. Hello, Paul. Could you explain what you think is actually going on here with this move?
Well, what I think is going on is that Bozideng has for many years been a very solid, very run-of-the-mill, straight down the line clothing manufacturer in China. Pretty good quality, not very exciting designs. The growth of the middle class, the growth of the massive interest in luxury and better quality in China has really been boom time for the European brands, and the Chinese brands haven't really had a shot at that, even though many of them, like Bozideng, actually manufacture for high quality brands in the West. So they want to produce products that have really good margins, the way that luxury brands do. And they want to sell them to the Chinese, but the Chinese remain really quite obsessed with foreign brands. So one way of getting around this might be to actually bring in European designers, which has been done before, but also a European factory manufacturer, which has been done before, but also just to open a store, as you say, right on South Moulton Street, right on the best end of Oxford Street, and right opposite the stores that Chinese tourists to London love, like John Lewis and particularly Selfridges.
So just to paint a picture for me, is Bozideng actually kind of more mid-market than an elite brand? Is it, if you're saying it's competing with the likes of John Lewis, do you think it's actually a bit of a mixed kind of message that it's going on a street like South Moulton Street, which is known for the likes of Browns, which is a very high-end boutique? What's its real kind of position in the market?
What Bozideng has done is, in China, it's moved itself from being someone that just made overcoats and kind of, very functional but not very exciting sort of cold weather gear, because they're from the north of China. They've started to make sort of smarter clothes for men, as we've seen a great growth of white-collar employment in China. They make sort of suits. I'd call it kind of sub-Hugo Boss, you know, lots of black suits, white shirts, quite streamlined tailoring, which obviously suits the general male shape in China as well. What they're actually doing, and they've been quite successful with that, what they're actually doing on South Moulton Street, though, is they're actually doing a line that isn't even available in China, but very limited editions, very high-end. But with all the tourists coming into town from China, benefiting from the high renminbi and the low pound, it's very important that they see Bozideng on the British high street. Not that British people are going to buy anything from there particularly, but that they may just think, we went to London and we saw Bozideng, so maybe, you know, they're a bit better than we thought they were, although I think that's quite a big gamble for Bozideng to take back home.
Yeah, Paul, I was going to ask that. Do you think this is actually going to work?
I think that you should never underestimate the Chinese love and knowledge of foreign luxury brands. It's not just simply that they're foreign. I hear all the time that just the Chinese just like things because they're foreign. That's not true. The Chinese do have a very good appreciation of quality, quality materials, quality production, quality design. And because of the way China's economy has grown in the last 30 years, it's a very mass production-based economy. At the moment, that's not what China does. Maybe they can turn it around, but it's not just simply that Chinese people think that everything foreign is best. They have very good and very sound reasons for preferring foreign brands to domestic.
And just very finally on that point, quickly, could you just tell me, do you think that the Chinese, the Made in China label is actually a bit toxic even for the Chinese elite customer?
Yes, I think so. It might actually be more toxic for the Chinese elite customer than it is for anyone else, actually, because the Chinese elite customer actually sees a lot more of what goes on than the rest of us do. I think that, you know, these kind of tricks, if you like, of doing using Western designers to produce things in limited numbers in the West is not ultimately how the Made in China brand is going to be recovered. That's going to be a much longer story about the growth of innovation and an appreciation for design and craftsmanship that's going to grow in China. The good news is we know the Chinese are willing to pay for craftsmanship, so that's the big hurdle got over. Now we just need to see the designers and the innovators come through the system there to develop things.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for that. That was Paul French from Mintel. Now, I'm joined in the studio by our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who has a few opinions about China and Made in China as a label and its value and its and the issues it faces. What do you think of this move by Bosideng, Tyler? Do you think it is actually going to be a potential success?
I think, as Mr. French was saying, that I think they've got the work cut out for them, because if you look back historically, I think there's been many brands which have probably gone to their board and said, look, we've identified a great piece of real estate in Paris, in London, or New York. We're going to open up this great flagship, and what it's going to do, it's going to create this wonderful halo over our brand. And guess what? By the time we meet around this boardroom table, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to see, you know, a 4 or 5 or double-digit percent increase. I don't think there are many historical examples of that. I was just, when I was listening to Mr. French talk about this, it made me think a little bit about Uniqlo and Uniqlo's foray into the UK the first time around. And you're talking about, what, some probably 15 years ago, when they came to this market, they left Japan, and the idea was that they would open up a series of stores in London. They did want to target the British customer, no question, but they thought that would create a halo effect going back to Japan. It didn't happen that time. We've now seen Uniqlo go out to the market again with flagships, Paris, London, New York, you know, designed by Wonderwall, these fantastic stores, because, of course, you know, they know that they've got a brand which is slightly challenged in the Japanese market, but still, I think they've really been firing on all cylinders. You know, both what they've been doing internationally and from a Japanese perspective. So I don't think that you can look at sort of the Bosideng example and say that they could do a Uniqlo as well. I think and just going South Moulton Street, you have to remember this is a pedestrian street. It really has to be on the Chinese shoppers' agenda. And you would think if you were going to have a flagship, you'd want it on a street with a lot of traffic, not just a case of people walking through the door, because this isn't going to be what's going to happen at the till at the end of the day. It's how is the Chinese consumer going to feel about the brand when they get on their flight back to Beijing or Shanghai.
Now, Paul was touching there on the toxicity of the Made in China label, and we know many of the reasons for that. We only have to see the reports from Chinese factories to understand that many people associate a Made in China label with poor working conditions and certainly a kind of tough time for anyone who's working as a seamstress. Do you think that any brand, until China begins to change its kind of working practices, is going to be stuck with that as that toxicity at home and abroad?
I think we've been talking about this topic almost since, well, even before we went on air, but certainly since the launch of this magazine. And there's been, of course, a lot of focus over the last 24 months on Foxconn, what's happened there. I think that is just the start of really a massive backlash against Made in China. And it's one thing when we consider how various electronic devices are made, but as you're pointing out, I think the situation is far worse for so many fashion companies. So, of course, I think, you know, not just the Chinese elite. I just think, you know, the burgeoning middle class there, they're very familiar with what's happening, probably behind many of those gated compounds, and they don't want to be associated with it. And there's no question that the Chinese consumer, you know, look at what's happening again. If you look at the Japanese market, Ginza on a Saturday afternoon. You see the Chinese consumer going into Japan, and they want Made in Japan, which is, you know, quite remarkable. But at the same time, they also want Made in the UK, and they want Made in France, and they want Made in Italy.
So we won't be seeing you in a Bosideng puffer jacket anytime soon.
Well, probably not. I mean, Bosideng, which also sounds a bit like Mao Zedong as well. And I think it's actually not surprising that they've actually cornered the new party uniform, black suits and white shirts.
It's strange that it's all black suits that they're selling. It doesn't sound the most exciting offering. Well, that was our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who has kindly given his view on brand China and the move by Bosideng, who has announced it's opening a store even, on London's South Moulton Street in a bid to get rid of its toxic image, or the Made in China toxic image, I should say. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and in the next half hour, we're going to be rounding up this week's key foreign affairs stories and also getting involved in an Italian brawl.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport.
we're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
What Cannes is to film and Venice to architecture, the city of Arles is to photography. Our Monocle film crew headed down to the south of France for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Arles, the world's leading photography festival.
Photographers love a group hug. There's a lot of talk of apertures and shutter speeds and white balance in bars and parties across town. Everyone's at it, shooting everything in sight. Everyone's got their eye on everything and how everyone else might be framing it for a shot. It's a life through a lens in Arles.
Monocle Films, focus on photography on monocle.com.
It's Monday, and you know what that means, foreign affairs. Because this time every week we get in Steve Bloomfield to talk about the key issues in the world of foreign affairs. But today we have two people here. We have Steve, and he's also joined by Sophie Grove, our senior editor. Now, we're always a bit confused, aren't we? Because senior editor sounds like she's your boss, foreign editor.
It also sounds like she's your boss as well, to be honest.
And I think she may be, actually. I think that's the way the world is heading.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Now,
hello, Andrew.
Hello. Foreign affairs. Mm. What do you know about that, Steve? What's the key issue?
What do I know? God, this sounds like my job interview now.
No, what's the key? Where are we going to start today?
We are going to look at some of the stories that are sort of not really making the main headlines at the moment. Because obviously the two big stories that are taking up a lot of everyone's time at the moment are Syria, what's happening there, a rolling story which we're also going to be covering on tonight's Monocle Daily, and obviously the Eurozone crisis. Do you want to know what the Spanish bond yield is right now?
I think we're going to be finding out about later in the show because we have an expert on. So,
okay.
So don't you weigh into that. That's a story for later on. We have someone from the FT who actually knows what he's talking about.
I know what I'm talking about. 7.11%. There we are.
Okay.
We're not going to talk about those two stories
because those are big
two stories. Well, the main thing we're going to talk about is South Sudan. And that's also why Sophie's here, because she's just come from South Sudan. Not just literally. But, you know, 10 days ago?
It was 10 days ago. I mean, not much has really changed in the sense I was in some refugee camps up in the north of South Sudan, so kind of on the border there. It was really quite shocking to see how many people were arriving every single day. And that's what we wanted to discuss on the show, just to look at some of the unresolved problems between the split.
I was going to ask you, is this still the people who were South Sudanese, who we covered this some weeks ago, who were making their way from the north, trying to cross over into South Sudan in time for the division of the country? And so many people didn't make it, did they, on time? Is it still that stream of people coming across?
Well, to put this whole thing in context, you know, the two Sudans split a year ago. They've just celebrated their one-year anniversary. South Sudan's an independent country. Celebrated, perhaps a bit of a strong word, marked, because certainly that year hasn't been as good as they expected it to be. They've had all sorts of problems. And one of them is this unresolved issue over the border and the relationship between North Sudan, Khartoum, and South Sudan. And there are two main problems. One is what to do with the oil. Two-thirds of all the oil in the two Sudans is now in the south. So the south very happy about that. Great, we've got all the oil, lots of money. 98% of their economy is based on this oil. The problem is the oil pipeline goes through the north up to Port Sudan, just beyond Khartoum. So they've had to work together on this because the south can't just, you know, whip up a quick pipeline of their own heading south to the sea. So they've had to work together. And they had this massive dispute over what should happen with the oil. The South Sudanese said to the North, we'll pay you $1 a barrel for using your pipeline. The North said, we'd like $36 a barrel. And so in the end, the South said, well, we won't send any oil at all. They basically did cut off their nose to spite their face. So now both countries are in severe, severe economic problems. And they've been involved in some sorts of talks over the past few months, talks interspersed with lots of fighting.
Now, Sophie, can I ask you, because you were there with the elders, this group of incredible statesmen and women who go in to kind of mediate in these kind of issues. And is that, was that part of the reason they were there, trying to find some way out of this impasse?
Exactly. And there's a high-level implementation panel which is chaired by Thabo Mbeki at the African Union. And he's the really pushing through the main negotiations. And the elders, in the form of Martti Ahtisaari, the former president of Finland, and Mary Robinson, also Archbishop Desmond Tutu, they were there to sort of really try and sort of push through the peace negotiations that and Becky's in charge of. But they're really focused on this area around the Blue Nile. So it's a place that was really unresolved when the split happened. They didn't demark the borders well enough, and there's a whole group of people that are sort of left there. And what happened this week was the talks just came to a shuddering halt, because there's the South accused the North of continuing to bomb people on that border area. And I mean, I saw the evidence myself, because, you know, there were these thousands of people arriving every day coming from the North, where they'd been bombarded by aerial helicopters and shells, and arriving in the South. There are largely Muslims, but Igasi, black Muslims, coming, and you could see that this had happened to them. The little children were actually building bomb shelters by the side of the road, because they thought that really every time a plane or a UNHCR plane flew over, they thought that you know, their number was up, and so they'd run into it, which is evidence itself that the bombardment's happening. But obviously the South says it is, and the North says it isn't.
So all these issues are interlinked. It's the question over the demarcation of the border, questions over who owns oil, the oil transshipment, this then causes the problems of the refugees. And are the elders trying to involve themselves with all of those issues, or are they mainly involved with this, more of the actual demarcating the border as an initial step?
They're trying to get the talks to really they're trying to get the two parties to meet face-to-face, because at the moment the negotiations are really a farce. I mean, they don't really sit down and talk to each other. And al-Bashir in the North hasn't wanted to meet with the southern leader, who said, I was at a speech that he gave, and he's called Salva Kiir. He said, oh, he's welcome to come here at any time. He's even welcome to come to our independence celebrations, which, considering he's been indicted by the ICC and is seen as a kind of absolutely one of the worst war criminals around, is a bit unlikely. But at the same time, they want bilateral talks, and that's what the elders were trying to do.
And Steve, do you think that's possible?
Yes, it is. And they're sort of happening ish in that the African Union has a plan, which the UN Security Council has backed, whereby if the two sides don't agree a deal on the oil by August the 2nd, and by a deal on the oil that has to include security as well around that, they'll impose sanctions on both Khartoum, Sudan, and South Sudan as well. So that is starting to concentrate minds. And at the African Union summit last week, Salva Kiir and Omar al-Bashir actually met for the first time in a long time. And, you know, there was a picture of them sort of happily shaking hands with each other. So something is happening. About an hour or so ago, the South announced that they're willing to offer a bit more money than they had before. So they really need to get this sorted by the 2nd of August. Whether they will, I don't know.
I was just going to ask you quickly whether you think that actually Salva Kiir has had a bit of an easy ride, in a sense, because, you know, there tends to be some empathy for the underdog, the smaller partner, this fledgling nation. But in fact, are both countries kind of as bad as each other in a way? They're using their kind of might and their kind of anger at each other.
All through the Civil War, which lasted about 20 years, ended in 2005, the South was seen as the good guys. They were the ones who were, on the whole, being oppressed. And they had an awful lot of support from the US as well, in this odd sort of level of support from conservative evangelical Christians, who saw it as very much a religious-based war. When that was one aspect, but not the major thing. So there's going to be... it's going to be very, very difficult. Can I just add one tiny thing of good news from South Sudan? And that is, it's Olympic linked.
Okay, like cool.
There's a South Sudanese athlete called Gur Marial who runs in the marathon, wanted to run in the marathon at the Olympic Games, was told he couldn't run in the marathon for South Sudan because South Sudan wasn't yet registered with the International Olympic Committee, the IOC said, it's all right, why don't you just run under the Sudanese flag? To which he said, no, absolutely not. They've relented today and said he can run as an independent. So there you are.
Hooray. That's very good. We like to end on a happy note. Well, that was our senior editor, Sophie Grove, and foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. And in the next half hour of the show, we're going to be heading to Tuscany, where they're slugging out in the olive groves over plans to merge two provinces.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Esse Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Monaco 24, Tagatia.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24, Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The Bruja Jalava.
Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
It's 18:25 here in London, that's 13:25 in New York, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. We turn now to a tale to rival Romeo and Juliet. Where the Capulets and the Montagues slugged it out on the pages of Shakespeare, the modern tale takes us to Italy's political stage, where finances are tight. The country's prime minister has decided that fewer, bigger regions will cost the state less, and has decided that some are going to have to merge. But what Mario Monti's plans don't take into account is the rivalry that exists between regions. The cities of Lucca and Pisa, in particular, have a healthy hatred of each other, which dates back to medieval times. Earlier, we spoke to Andrea Pieroni from the region of Pisa. He describes the nature of the rivalry between the two towns.
Ma io credo che queste rivalità ormai siano fatti storici che non hanno.
This rivalry stems from the past. It's connected to folklore and history. I think a process of reunification is mature. There's always going to be some arguments and so on, but this is something that's unavoidable. So far today, we haven't seen much opposition. You only really see rivalry on the football pitch, but when we talk about politics, we think you need to work together.
Well, that was Andrea Pieroni, who's the president of the province of Pisa. Now, joining me on the line is Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, who also has some strong opinions about how Italy is run and what its cities are like. Ivan, could you just explain to us a little bit what this battle is really about? We're talking there about this kind of ancient kind of feuds between the two, but it's a more contemporary tale, really, isn't it, that's pushing events?
Yeah, good evening, Andrew. That's correct. What's going on is Mario Monti has decided to abolish part of the third tier of Italy's government. You have the state government, and then below that you have the regions, 20-odd regions, then you have these 107 provinces, and then you, of course, have cities and towns. And this provincial level is seen by a lot of people as a place where they can cut out some of the fat, where some of the services can be given over to like large cities, for example, or the regions. And what they've done is they've cut down some of these smaller provinces that were only 100,000 people, and they're trying to merge some of them together and then also give some of the services up to the regions. So this is part of Mario Monti's efforts, of course, to cut in the next 3 years about 26 billion euros. And so he's hoping to, this way, that the central government in Rome doesn't have to give money to some of these authorities, because they see that there's a lot of waste, there's a lot of public sector employees that they think they can still slim down several thousand still. So within that, of course, you have these things that you had mentioned about these regions, these provinces, these areas that, you know, historically when people think about, say, Tuscany, these small city-states that at one time were rivals and going to war. But, of course, nowadays, a lot of that is just for the football matches on Saturday.
But to be blunt, does he have a hope in hell of getting people to do this? Because, you know, every time you see that someone trying to reform the Italian state, nothing happens.
Well, you know, he passed this decree that was set up on Friday, that was mentioned on Friday. Of course, okay. It then has to go through the organs of Parliament, because, of course, even though he has the government, they have to go to Parliament and have put these things to a vote. So we'll see. There have been lots of talk about wanting to abolish several provinces in the past. Of course, when it came to a vote, the politicians at that time didn't bite the bullet. So it's going to be interesting to see if he's able to get people on board. I mean, right now, Mario Monti still enjoys a fair bit amount of support. So, and everyone knows that cost cutting is key right now because Mario Monti has said that, you know, Italy does not need a bailout. People are looking at Greece and Spain, and now they're sort of eyeing Italy. And he's trying to reassure markets and also the citizens that he doesn't have to, they don't have to go to the IMF or Brussels. And also this cutting of this provincial government, or reducing these number of provinces, is also to avoid the VAT tax going up later this year. It's already gone up to 21%, and he's trying to stave that off because that would obviously hit consumers, people who are buying day-to-day items.
Can I ask you just finally, personally, for you, you know, you're sitting in Milan, you know, a more wealthy city, a bigger kind of region, obviously with 3 million people living in the province. Do you get any sense Italy is changing at the moment, that costs are being cut, that the state is being reformed? Are you aware of that actually happening?
On a day-to-day level, I would say there's slight subtleties in the changing of people's attitudes. Of course, Mario Monti, people have talked a lot about the campaign against tax evasion, cracking down on the use of cash and trying to get people to use credit cards or bank accounts for transfer so they can monitor funds and see that people are paying their taxes. I still think we have a long way to go because people are feeling the pinch right now. And right now, there's a lot of resentment. So, and obviously it's just, he's only been in power, 6 months. It's not a long time to overhaul a country of 60 million people. So I still think that, you know, the jury is out.
Well, great. And that was Ivan Carvalho, who's our Milan correspondent, giving us his view on the attempt to merge some Italian provinces to save a little bit of money. Now, in the next half hour on the programme, we'll also be looking at how guerrilla marketing could hijack the Olympics, getting the latest aviation news, and we'll also talk to a man with the finest pair of lungs in the Alps. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The European Union has tightened an arms embargo on Syria and expanded other sanctions as the conflict between President Bashar al-Assad and rebels escalates towards civil war. The new embargo rules require EU countries to search planes and ships if they have reasonable grounds to suspect they're carrying arms, dual-use goods, or equipment used for repression to Syria. The American man accused of killing 12 people in a shooting at a Batman film screening in Aurora, Colorado, has appeared in court for the first time. The man, 24-year-old James Holmes, sat in court in a red prison suit with dyed orange hair. 9 of 58 people wounded by the gunman remain in critical condition. A gunman wearing an Afghan uniform has turned his weapon against foreign trainers working for NATO in the western province of Herat, killing 3 people. The shootings come at the end of a grim 24 hours for the coalition government, which also saw 5 NATO soldiers killed. Spain's economy has sunk deeper into recession in the second quarter, according to its central bank. It's believed investors have been spooked by an undeclared funding crisis in the Spanish regions and are pushing the country ever closer to a full bailout. And the European Commission has said that the next disbursement of aid for Greece will probably not be paid before September. International lenders first have to finish an assessment of Greek reforms that are far behind schedule. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the Herculean efforts by some people to circumvent the Olympic branding restrictions.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afton Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, much has been made of the row about what can or cannot be used to promote your brand during the Olympics. Precise boundaries have been laid out in the British statute books, and almost 300 monitors will police the streets to ensure that no one is stepping out of line. But where do these boundaries lie? Why is the British Museum within the remit by using an image of a racing athlete from a piece of ancient ceramics, but a butcher who loops his sausages into the shape of the Olympic rings, pushing his luck? To tell us more and to discuss the larger issues of branding at the Olympics, I'm joined by John Reynolds from the UK's Campaign magazine on the line. And in the studio, we have Marketing Director of Ipsos Mori, Jonathan Weeks. I'm going to jump to you, John, first of all. Could you just tell us, do you think that there will be companies who are planning guerrilla marketing attempts at hijacking the Olympics?
Yeah, you've got to be careful about the wording. I think, I suppose if you look at examples like Adidas or an Olympic sponsor, so you look at their rivals, you look at people like Nike, and I think Nike have already done quite a lot of work which sort of just treads the line carefully. It doesn't transgress any rules. But, I mean, if people saw their advertising, they would immediately think of the Olympics. But a lot of these brands are sort of canny about what they can and can't do. So they sort of tread the line carefully. So you will see work out there which you immediately, that's linked to the Olympics, but it won't transgress any official rules.
Do you think there's some benefit of not being the official brand? You know, it's interesting, I keep thinking that for Pepsi, so many people are mentioning, you know, what would it be like if you wore a Pepsi t-shirt to the event? You know, what about Pepsi? In a way, they're getting as much publicity through not being the sponsor as Coca-Cola is through being the actual official sponsor.
Yeah, I think the whole funny thing about that particular example was the fact that I haven't seen anyone actually wear a Pepsi t-shirt for like 25 years.
They need to bring them out.
Yeah, they need to bring them back. But there is some, we've written stories, we've had stats before, which has shown that asking the sort of public which brand resonates with them most is linked to the Olympics. And the examples have been people like Nike and people like Tesco who aren't sponsors. But I mean, just going back to the previous point, the sort of create that image where they're sort of linked to London 2012 without actually paying the hefty, you know, million pounds of sponsorship money.
Now, John, don't go away, because I just want to cut to Jonathan, who's here with me in the studio. Jonathan, many people thought this was going to be like a boom time for advertising, and that actually it's turning out that lots of brands are a bit cautious about spending any money because they think they'll just be blotted out by everything that's happening at the Olympics, and especially on commercial television, they're worried about even placing their advertising.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there is a huge amount of money that's been put to the Olympics by the sponsors, and obviously they want their return on investment. When you're putting the likes of £65 million in, certainly you want to protect your investment and make sure you're getting sufficient return on that. Behind that, there is the emphasis that they need to balance off the positive sentiment that they want to create by having their brand associated. But also, when you are looking to defend and potentially pursue other brands that may be encroaching on your territory through guerrilla marketing, you need to balance that with what sort of is there going to be any negative sentiment that's going to come from that as well?
And do you think, I wondered whether this is a bit of an old-fashioned game. Maybe this is the last Olympics where they'll ever be able to kind of have these rules. Because in a sense, what you notice through anything to do with social media now is that it's it's so leaky, you can't control what people say and do. So, for example, I imagine there will be thousands of people in the stadium with their phones. They can tweet, they can send messages, they can put things on Facebook. That there's no way that the sponsors or the official authorities can control. Again, do you think that in a way they're trying to kind of hold back this kind of official line, and it is almost impossible to do these days?
I think there's a balance to strike here between what the individual or a small group of individuals can achieve through, say, social media, and when you have very active ambush marketing. For example, in the 2010 World Cup, a beer brand was pulled up for trying to organise guerrilla marketing within venues. There's a very big difference between the two things. So I think, yes, there's still a place for the individual voice through social media, but it's more the larger activity that the Locog will be watching out for.
And John, can I ask you the same question? Do you feel that it's just a changed advertising environment in a way that you can't control everything these days, that social marketing, whether we like it or not, or whether we believe in it or not, it does just change the game a bit?
Yeah, I'd agree with the last comments. But I mean, I think this idea that the sponsors, the big ticket sponsors, will be sort of swayed away from not sponsoring future Olympics is way off. I mean, they're paid. These are big multinational companies, and they really believe in this Olympic ideal and what they get out of it. So I think there will be. I think you'll still see these the big ticket companies still sponsoring, you know, the Olympics for the next sort of, you know, 10 to 20 years. And then as things change over time, that might differ. But I think in the immediate future, I can't see any change in the case of sponsors still scrambling to be associated with the Olympics, I would have thought.
And what do you think is the dividend, John, for the bottom line of these companies? You know, if you are the official, you know, sponsor, for example, McDonald's. Do you think that you'll see, you know, 10% of your sales, you know, go up over the next, you know, year? Do you think there's actually cash that comes into your company through this sponsorship?
Good question. the honest answer to that is I don't know. I think sort of probably internally at McDonald's, it creates a good buzz and it's a nice thing to be associated with. But I mean, that's a big question. I've asked marketing directors that for a number of years and they haven't been able to convince me that they get a sort of a tangible reward from the Olympics.
And Jonathan, again, when you look at this, you know, what's taking place, do you think it's, you know, it's a good thing for these brands to get involved with the Olympics? Do you think that they will get this kind of cachet from being associated with the Olympics?
Certainly they're going to be getting a lot of noise about their brand and people seeing their brand and their logos. I think that being able to provide the funds and be relatively philanthropic and support the Olympics is a good thing for the larger brands to do, and the legacy that it can leave, particularly in the UK and in the areas that it can develop. Whether that becomes more tangible through sales is obviously time will tell. But primarily it's making sure that they have the opportunity to do this and get their voice heard and their brand mentioned rather than their competitors. So we can see a level of defensive stance to it as well.
And perhaps finally, John, do you think that, you know, if you were somebody who was advising a brand who didn't have access to, you know, being an official sponsor, do you think that it's worth risking it by going out and kind of breaking a few rules? Are the sanctions against you actually that tough if you go and slap a few kind of sausage-shaped Olympic rings in the window of your butcher's shop, for example?
No, but I mean, you've got to remember these rules. I mean, people keep picking up on these sort of cases where it's like a small village butchers. But I mean, these rules are in place to protect the likes of Coke and McDonald's from their sort of big rivals. So they're there to protect Coke from, I don't know, Pepsi doing anything, or McDonald's from doing, you know, McDonald's from Burger King doing anything. The media seems to grasp on these small cases. But I mean, I wouldn't, I don't know. I mean, I think in the case of these, the case you mentioned there, I mean, I can't see any more than a small fine or maybe a ticking off or a phone call saying, don't do that again.
Are you going to the Olympics, John?
Yeah, I've got tickets for the handball, of all things.
Handball? Well, that's good. Well, it's better than anything else. It's good to take part, isn't it? And Jonathan, are you managing to get along to the Olympics?
I'm afraid not at the moment. I'm looking to try and find some tickets at the last minute if I can.
Okay, so if anyone wants to contact Ipsos Mori, Jonathan Weeks is your man, and he needs
please.
A couple of tickets.
Thank you.
Well, John Revels from Campaign Magazine and Jonathan Weeks from Ipsos Mori, thank you very much for putting us through the Olympic rings.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. As the markets opened this morning, the euro began to tumble. Fears over Spain's worsening debt drove the currency to the lowest it's been against the yen. Spain has banned the practice of short selling, where the markets bet on falling share prices to try and stop things tumbling any lower. Joining us on the line is Quentin Peel, Berlin's bureau chief for the Financial Times. Quentin, can I first ask you, what seems strange is that there doesn't seem to be a huge reaction from Germany. Do you think the Germans are just kind of had enough of kind of this as an ongoing saga and just believe it will sort itself out?
Yes, I think it is a strange reaction here because the German market got clobbered as well today. But nonetheless, I think they're absolutely convinced that this is all, if you like, a bit of a storm in a teacup, that they're on the right track, Spain's doing the right stuff to get its economy right, and they're just refusing to react. Now, whether they're actually, in denial, because clearly there are big worries out there in the markets. At the same time, what happens for Germany is that the money is coming into all German government bonds, and the Germans are actually borrowing at negative interest rates now. People are having to pay the Germans to buy their bonds, which is an extraordinary situation.
Now, the Spanish finance minister, Luis de Guindos, is heading to Berlin, I believe, tomorrow. Do you know why he's coming to visit Berlin?
Well, they're being very, very cautious about saying anything. They just said he'll be talking about the future of Spain. This is a regular meeting. But clearly, they are sitting down to sort of, sort out, at one extent, their differences. There's still a difference between the Germans and the Spaniards because the Germans are insisting that this program that's now on track, this 100 billion euro program to recapitalize the weakest Spanish banks, the Germans are adamant that it is the Spanish government that must be the ultimate guarantor of that program, whereas the Spaniards are saying the trouble is that knocks us in the markets again because it makes us look as if we're accumulating more debt. So it's really doing exactly the wrong thing. So they've got to sort that out. But I think it's probably more a strategic chat to try and actually say, look, how long can we sweat this one out? It's a very weird period in the markets now because I think what we're also seeing is turnover getting pretty thin. People are going on holiday now, so there's much less dealing in the market. And so on a thin turnover, obviously, if you get big moves, they can become quite sharp.
And just cutting back to a story that perhaps was running like 10 days ago is what's happening in France as well. So do you think there's a kind of a split between the power zones, that actually countries like Spain are kind of thinking, actually, let's look at what Hollande is doing in France. Perhaps we should go more his way, a little less austerity. Perhaps we don't have to kind of take all the kind of German medicine. Or do you think that Germany still is confident that it's kind of running the whole show and that people will finally fall in line with what it wants?
I think the Germans do feel that even the French will be forced to fall in line in the end because the French themselves have got a very difficult budget position to come to terms with and they're going to have an austerity program. But having said that, yes, there's a temptation on the other side for the Spaniards, the Italians and the French to all get together. Now, in particular, I think one of the big pressures is the Spaniards and the French both think that the European Central Bank should be intervening much more forcefully in the markets. This is something the Germans don't want to see. They don't want to see the central bank used to do the job of government, if you like. So I think that's something that the Spaniards and the French will actually see eye to eye on and disagree with Germany about.
And finally, while you're sitting here, while you're sitting in Berlin, kind of looking out across Europe, do you get the sense that, that this is a story that's just going to keep on unfolding and that Germany is the kind of one safe zone within Europe? Or do you feel that, actually things are beginning to kind of settle down a little bit?
I think it's going to be a very bumpy ride for a really quite long time. It's a depressing thought. But I think we're into, if you like, a game that's going to go on not for months, it's going to go on for years. And that is it's going to be very difficult because there are some really fundamental reforms that need to be done to get the Eurozone to work better, and those cannot be done overnight. They need to have much more integration of their economic policies in the Eurozone. It's going to take a long time for them all to actually agree how far they can go to give up sovereignty, pool their sovereignty, and create a much more integrated, tightly knit, even political union in Europe. And those words are really scary, not just to the British, but also to the French.
Well, Quentin, the one good thing about it going on for years and years is I guess we'll get to talk to you quite a lot more over the coming months. So thank you very much for that. That was Quentin Peel, who's the Berlin Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Now it's from Berlin to Beirut because we're going to have a very summery track. This is Zaid and the Wings with Ocean. Well, that was Ocean by Zaid and the Wings, who we first met on the Monocle Summer Series back in 2010 when we flew him and his team into London. And if you want to find that track or more by Zaid and the Wings anyway, you should get the Monocle CDs. And all you have to do is go to monocle.com to order your copies. How about that? Now, it's 1852 in London and you're listening to Midori House. And we can have a bit of a horny story now, because the people of Nandaz must be removing their earplugs this afternoon. This weekend, the Swiss town played host to a very noisy battle. More than 10,000 people attended the 11th International Alphorn Festival. Hundreds of players gathered around the lake to play, and a handsome sound it must have been. Well, maybe. Part of the festivities included the International Alphorn Championship, and its victor, Hans Matt, is going to join me on the line now from Switzerland. Hans, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, hello.
Hello. Now, tell me, first of all, what makes a champion hornblower?
It was a big competition with nearly 100 people. And then on Saturday, and every group and solo have to play. And then on Sunday, the final of the finalists, the five first place of groups have to play on 2,200 meter top of the mountain to the final, and then I played in co-alphorn and büchel. Büchel is another instrument from Switzerland. It's more higher than alphorn, but the same typical. And I was in the final for in both instruments. So. And I was winning the first and the second play in the final. It was really happy. It was a great day.
Congratulations. That's amazing. Now, can you just tell me, what are the judges looking for when they listen to you blow your horn?
What they're looking for?
Yeah, what are the judges looking for? Is it noise? Is it the quality of the tune?
The quality of the tune is the noise, and it's how loud, how light, you know, the opposite of loud. And how correctly the tune, how correctly each tune to the order, anything but what we're looking for in a big orchestra, you know.
And how young were you when you first started blowing your horn?
It's 17 years ago. I'm 54 now.
Is there a chance that we could get you to do it on the radio?
I think so. I'm now in my living room and I have my horn here. Normally I play outside. It's an outside instrument, you know, especially in the mountains. You can alphorn about 8 or 10 kilometers away if it's a really quiet night or a day
okay.
In the mountains.
Well, we shouldn't have it too long ago, but if we could hear you blow your horn now, that would be amazing.
I can do it.
Okay, we're all waiting.
Okay.
Are your lips around it now? You're ready to go? Hans, that was amazing. Just tell me, is that a traditional local tune?
Yes, maybe it's inside in a house. It's very, very more soundy or noisy. Outside, the tune go more away to the in the air, you know.
Now, can I ask you, when you're practicing at home, is that a bit complicated for your next door neighbours when you're blowing your horn all night?
No, I'm blowing the horn normally never at home. I have to go to the forest, I have to go on a small mountain outside here, or if it's really much raining, I go under the bridge, not far away from me, so we have a little lake, so I go under the root bridge, and the sound is like in a church or in a cathedral, you know, very nice. So I do all my practice there, and or on the end of a forest, in a small valley where we have also a good echo.
So just for the listeners, can you tell us actually how long is it? How long is your horn?
3 meters and 40 centimeters.
Wow, and is that something you make yourself or you inherit it?
No, I buy it from a special builder, you know. They have some of really good Alpine builders in Switzerland. And if you're really a special wood practical, you can do it. You can do one, but maybe it's not so good as this one, you know. There is three generation is Alpine building, and they each give the know-how to the other, and so they do really good.
Well, Hans, thank you so much. That was Hans Matt, who's the international Alpine champion and a great man indeed. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Emma Nelson, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next, it's the news. Then it's going to be this week's episode of The Culture with Robert Bound. And in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Ted Kravitz and Andrew Muller will be here with the Monocle Daily. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, will be back tomorrow with Midori House at the same time. But for now, I'm Andrew Tuck. Thank you very much for listening, and a big toot-toot goodbye.